Hi, this is Danielle from the Jaws Curator, and first things first, happy 2018. This is the first episode in a brand new year, and just like every episode since 2015, it is supported by Saatchi Art, the world's largest curated online gallery offering original art by independent artists from around the world. Check out their huge roster of very talented artists at saatchiart.com. And what has also become a new normal is the first episode of each month being co-sponsored by the amazing women at Thrive. They have a fantastic program called Thrive Mastermind, which is open to female and female-identified artists all over the world. Each mastermind group has 10 women who meet every month, either online or in person, to talk about the ups and downs of being artists. I am in one of the online groups, and I absolutely love it. If you're looking for this kind of support and accountability, the accountability is the big one, head to their website, thriveartstudio.com. So, the first episode of 2018 was actually recorded at the very end of 2017. There was talk of drips, spikes, blobs, splutes, and sparkly crystals. Yep, I had the chance to talk to the very sweet, smart, and insanely talented Dan Lamb, who is a woman, by the way. Don't worry, right off the top we get into the whole Dan is a boy's name, is Danielle a boy's name extravaganza. This was such a fun and inspiring chat, and I am sure you will love it as much as I did. Ready? Calling Dan in Texas. Hi, Dan.
Hello.
How's it going?
It's going great.
I'm so happy to have you on here because I've written about you so many times and we've never actually spoken, so this is awesome.
Well, thank you for having me. I'm very excited to be here.
Yay! Well, there's a lot of questions because I don't know how the hell you do the thing that you do and how you even would have arrived at the things that you do. So I'm going to ask you all of that stuff. But if you've ever listened to the podcast, you'll know that I want to know what you were like as a little kid. So were you making art out of gum? What was going on back then?
When I was a kid, I was always very creative. I'm an only child, so I spent a lot of time alone. Mm-hmm. And, you know, just kind of, I would play with a lot of things. I would, like, make things out of boxes. I would draw. If anything I could get my hands on that I could make with, I would. As I got older, like, older being, like, middle school, maybe, like, 12, 13, I started playing with, like, wax. And so my inclination towards sort of, I guess, non-traditional media started pretty young. I never was felt confined to, like, the pen and the paper or the paintbrush and canvas.
That's cool. Well, did you, were you born in Texas?
I was not. Oh. I was actually born in the Philippines. My parents were refugees from Vietnam, and they were bouncing around in, like, Southeast Asia for, I believe, a couple years when they landed in Manila, where my mom was pregnant with me, and they stayed there for a while, and she had me there at a refugee camp.
Oh, my God.
And then, maybe like 2 or 3 months after that, my dad already had family in Houston, Texas, and so we were all able to get sponsored to come to the U.S.
Okay. So have you been back to the Philippines?
I have never been to the Philippines. I have been back to Vietnam quite a few times. I would love to visit the Philippines. I hear it's beautiful.
Yeah, that's so fun. How long were they there in that time? Do you know?
I think they were there for maybe, I want to say 6 months, maybe 5 months.
Mm-hmm. That must have been so terrifying and stressful.
I can't even imagine. I hear the stories of, you know, my mom and her escape from Vietnam and, like, the communists and all the, just the craziness it took to escape. And then there's a generation of people, and they call them boat people, who left the country. And, you know, people went missing at sea. People, you know, lost contact with their families. You know, people not knowing if they would find, like, a new home. My mom lost a couple of her siblings that way. So, you know, I can't even imagine for her. And she came to this country without speaking English, too. So she learned English here. So, I mean, yeah.
Wow, that's amazing. And then to throw having a baby. Mm-hmm. I mean, having a baby when you are set up in your community, in your home, with the family nearby is hard. Mm-hmm. Yeah. To do that in a refugee camp that is not your country, like, I can't even imagine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh, so, okay, so they get to Houston. So you just grow up American.
Yes, yeah, so my first language was Vietnamese, and I actually didn't learn, because my mom didn't speak it, but I didn't really learn English until I was in pre-K.
Mm-hmm.
And that's actually where the story of my name kind of, like, becomes interesting.
Okay,
so
yeah.
So my name is Dan in Vietnamese. It's pronounced Dang. And so, you know, growing up as just, like, a kid, that's what I went by. And then once I got to pre-K, to kindergarten, my teacher did roll call, and when she got to Dan, she said Dan, and I raised my little hand, and she was like, well, this can't be right. You're a girl, and this is a boy's name. So she changed in the role. She changed my name to Danielle, and that's what she wrote on all my folders, on all my, you know, books and all that stuff. And so my mom just adopted that, and so I grew up as Danielle. And until I got to college, you know, my freshman, sophomore year, I, you know, in college, you go through your identity thing, you know, you're mm-hmm. trying to discover who you are. And so I realized, well, hey, I was given this name by this woman who thought that my name was male. And so I kind of, like, shed that. And I was like, I don't want to go by this weird name that someone else gave me because I didn't fit into, like, her understanding of gender.
Yeah.
You know, whatever.
Yeah.
So I went back to Dan, and that's what I've been going as since then.
Oh, my word. Well, that is an awesome story because, I mean, you know, when I first found your work, I thought it felt feminine because of your colors and how tactile it was and everything. But then I saw your name and I was like, oh, I guess it's a guy.
Yeah.
But here's my Danielle story. So my dad's name is Dan.
Mm-hmm.
My parents swear up and down I was not named after him, but hello. Like,
yeah.
His name is Daniel, and I just have an extra L and an E. So I don't, but anyway, they swear that is not why I was named Danielle. And then until I was about, I'm going to say 14, I looked like a boy.
Oh.
I just had short hair. Like, I looked like a little boy. Even when I was at, like, 2, my mom said she had me in a little bikini bathing suit at the local pool, and someone said, oh, how cute, you put your boy in a bikini. She's like, no, it's a girl. and then having the name Danielle, often people would see me, and then in the roll call they would say Daniel, assuming that I was a boy, and I was like, I'm a girl. So I always hated the name Danielle because I associated it with being a boy, because my dad was Dan. And then when I was in third year university, I met this girl named Danielle who was beautiful. Mm-hmm. And I thought, wow, what a pretty name she has. And I was like, hold the phone, that's my name. And then I was okay with it after that.
That's very interesting. It's like the opposite of mine.
Yeah, yeah.
Weird.
I know, that's so weird. Well, there we go. Dan and Danielle taking on the world, whether people think we're boys or girls.
Doesn't even matter,
no. Okay, so what did your parents think when you were making things out of wax? Were they totally into you being into art, or were they worried about art, or what did they think?
Well, my parents divorced when I was young, and so it was really just me and my mom, and she worked. And so I think that she kind of just left me to my own, to do my own thing. I read a lot, and I made a lot of things. And so I think that that probably was good enough for her because I wasn't, like, out getting into trouble.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, my mom is also very creative, and maybe in different circumstances, she would have, you know, followed a bigger career in the arts, but she's a hairstylist now. And she was pretty encouraging. You know, growing up, I saw her draw. She would draw a portrait of me every year. And so that was always very exciting. And I, you know, it was like a yearly thing that I looked forward to. So I think that, you know, she probably saw that I was picking it up from her, and I think she liked it.
Yeah.
She's been encouraging for the most part of my career choice.
Does she still do your portrait every year?
No, she doesn't. I wish she did, but I don't know when she stopped. It was, yeah, I'm not sure when she stopped, but she probably just got too busy, and, you know.
Yeah, you should make her do it at some point.
I should.
Yeah,
yeah.
Resurrect it just one more time. And so did you go to art school?
I did. I went to undergrad was University of North Texas. That is located in Denton, Texas, which is like 45 minutes north of Dallas.
Okay.
And then I went to Arizona State for my master's in Phoenix. It's actually a little city called Tempe.
Oh, yeah.
Both of my degrees are in drawing and painting.
I know. So. I saw that on your website, and I was like, hold on a second.
Yeah.
And so did you even do anything remotely like your work now when you were doing your master's?
Yes. I actually, that's kind of where a lot of it started for me, with being able to explore on a larger scale the materials that I work with. I've always been naturally drawn to sculpture, but I think, you know, maybe whatever it is was in my head, this idea of how I best expressed myself was maybe, I thought, through painting.
Mm.
And that's why I followed that. But I think it's valuable, because I think I still approach sculpture like a painter. But yeah, like in grad school, I started, I was working with a lot of random things before grad school. I was using hot glue. That's when I started using resin. And then when I got to grad school, I started this kind of materials experimentation of like, what can I find that gets the aesthetic that I want, but is still functional in that they're not super heavy and super fragile.
Mm.
So I was using like plaster and like, you know, that if that fell, it would crack and, you know, all this stuff. And that's when I found polyurethane foam. Which is what I use now for the most part.
Oh my God. And so, okay, first of all, what were your paintings like? Were they kind of like this, but more two-dimensional?
Or
were they nothing like this?
They were, you know, I feel like now that I've had enough time with my work and years have gone by, I think that if you look back at all of my work, there are a lot of visual ties to what I do now. And so I think that you could definitely make a correlation, like, oh, that must be like an old, like, that looks like a Dan painting.
Okay.
Or whatever. So the colors, you know, my colors are still very bright and vibrant, and I have like a very distinct palette. My paintings were abstract, you know, of course.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
also very, you know, I was also like very interested in exploring texture and leaving the surface of the canvas or the panel. So those things are still there. Yeah,
did you use really thick paint?
I used a lot of like pouring mediums,
mm-hmm.
a lot of like gloss mediums, matte mediums. I did a lot of layering, which that's what led me to resin. I wanted something that could like get really thick layers and not crack. So then I found resin, and then, you know.
Hmm. And was that guidance from teachers, or was that just you playing around?
It was just me.
Yeah.
I expected to be met with some resistance as far as how much I was leaving the canvas. It was a thing. I was wondering if, you know, if I had to be confined to this 2D surface because I was getting a degree in drawing and painting.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I kind of expected some of the professors to be like, well, why are you doing this? Why aren't you in sculpture? But they were, for the most part, very supportive, and they just kind of let me do my own thing, which was very materials-based.
Yeah, that's so cool. So when you find this form, what is it, polyurethane?
Foam.
Foam. Mm-hmm. When you found that, was it like a eureka moment, or did it take some playing to master it?
It was a eureka moment in that it did what I wanted to do. It could be very thick and soft-looking. It mimicked, for me, what looked like kind of fat or skin or, you know, like something melting but like bodily.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was like a really beautiful thing, and I was so happy that I found it. As far as being able to sort of manipulate the material and what I could do with it, like the range of things, that took a while. And I feel like I still am learning things about it. There's certain elements about the material that you can't control. So you kind of have to adapt and work with it rather than against it.
Mm.
I
was wondering if it's like happy accidents, or do you like your drips and blobs, like do you have to plan them, or do you sort of let the material do its thing and then you react to that?
Mm-hmm. You know, it's because I know it well enough now, it's a balance between the two. I think that the beautiful thing about the material is that I can't control it completely. It is it's a two-part liquid that you mix together. And when you mix it together, it starts to chemically react and expand. And there's different densities of these foams. So depending on, you know, the look that I want or the buildup that I want, I'll use a different density. Just that factor alone can change up the whole process of, like, how much do I pour for it to be this long or for it to be this shape. So I can sort of dictate, you know, how much of something is there, but, and then, like, maybe how many legs are on, like, a drip sculpture, yeah. You know, but then there are happy accidents that happen, and I totally embrace those things, and I learn from it each time, so I realize, like, oh, the temperature in this room was, like, 75 degrees versus the 73 that's recommended. That may have affected, you know, how fast it expanded, or it's really cold in the room, you know, or it's more humid, so there's just all these kinds of things that go on that just play into it, and it takes a while to fully observe and get.
Yeah, I'm sure it must be so fun. Your studio must be so fun. I would just love to sit in there and watch.
It is very fun. I feel like that's a pretty big part of my process, is that a lot of times people they look at my work and they're like, wow, they look like they were fun to make. And I'm glad that comes through, because they definitely are.
Yeah.
And if it ever got boring, then I think that's a sign that
yeah.
It should change.
Yeah, for sure. Okay, so you're coming out of grad school. You've discovered all this. Things are happening. And then, so did you have a day job? Did you go right to showing work? Like, what happened after that?
So I graduated grad school, and I moved to this little town in the middle of Texas called Midland, Texas. My boyfriend was living and working there. And so, he was working for his family's business, and we decided he should give his family like a year, you know, to find his replacement or whatever. And then we would move back to Dallas or elsewhere.
Mm-hmm.
So during that year after grad school and before moving back to Dallas, I taught a couple classes at the community college in Midland.
Mm.
I taught art appreciation, and then I also just spent that time as kind of like I kind of saw it as a self-imposed, like, residency.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say.
Yeah, you know, like, I had a small studio space, and so I had to kind of adapt to working smaller and also evolve my work post-grad school because, things had changed. And that's when I sort of was more present on social media, because I thought there's very little culture in this small town. And so with the beauty of the internet and this connectedness that is like Instagram,
mm-hmm.
Let's see, like, what happens if I just post my work and put it out there. And that's kind of like how it started.
What year was that?
That was 2014.
Okay.
Yeah. 2014, 2015.
I must have found your work right around then.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
It was right when I was still making, like, the wall sculptures, like,
yep.
The wall blobs.
Yes.
And then right before I moved in December 2015, I made my first drip. And that's when, like, it just all exploded. Yeah.
Explosion from a drip. And okay, we'll get back on the timeline again. I keep getting distracted because I'm so curious about these things. Drips and blobs,
mm-hmm.
And you mentioned earlier that you were wanting it to look like skin or like body in some way. Is what's the reason behind that?
Well, it's not that I want it to look like skin or body necessarily, like in that direct way. I think what it is that it mimics the organicness of skin and body. So my work, I think what drives the work conceptually has a lot to do with, like, ideas of beauty and our expectations of beauty and what those things mean and what is beautiful, and then where's the line between it being too beautiful and what happens after that point. So too much beauty, much like, you know, eating like a delicious piece of cake, it's great, and then all of a sudden it's like, oh no, it's too much. And then you feel gross and you feel sick and you don't you know, you've been excessive, so you're like, no more. So it kind of, that's kind of what started my, like the thinking and the evolution of my work is sort of pushing those boundaries together. And then of course, like when you look at something that you immediately deem as ugly, like I did a lot of that. I did a lot of that kind of research. I looked at artwork and just things that I immediately reacted to as like, oh no, that's ugly. But then the longer I spent with it, the longer I became okay with it and realized like, no, it's not ugly. It just is this or that. And so I sort of defined my own aesthetics as I kind of evolved with the work too.
I love that so much. You know, it's funny. I was just working with an art advisor and she was saying, she challenged me because I was a graphic designer for so long. I like beautiful things, mm-hmm. right? And she challenged me to make something ugly.
Oh,
that's hard.
Yeah, it is hard. It is.
And then, but it is so interesting. Yeah. When you sit with something long enough, like if your gut is that's ugly, but if you sat with it long enough, you could find things about it that are in fact, you know, okay or beautiful in fact.
Yeah, definitely. Hmm. I also feel like sometimes even with beautiful things, something that is immediately beautiful, if you spend enough time with it, then you're like, oh, maybe, or it almost loses its glamour.
Yeah, yeah.
And it could be that it's just novelty, you know, like maybe the beauty or the ugliness in something is just the newness of it and something that we don't fully understand in ourselves yet. And so we react in this gut way, but then if we take the time to kind of, you know, marinate in it with our brains and our intellect, then we realize like, it's not as, I don't know.
Yeah, it's not whatever we thought originally. And you know, that's such a nice thought actually in this, speaking of social media and this, like, it's so fast paced that very often everything, like, just think about Instagram, right? It's like, don't like, you know, like,
yeah,
we don't really take time to marinate very often.
I totally agree. And I think that that's really after, you know, like with the work that I make, like, I think once I realized those things, or began on that sort of journey, now when I see work that if my immediate reaction is like curiosity versus just, oh, I like it or I don't like it, that's when I'm really like, oh yeah, like this thing. I have to make sense of it before I can decide. And that's like really exciting.
Mm-hmm. That's a really nice way to look at things. Smart, interesting. Okay, so after your 1 year Midland residency, did you guys move to Dallas?
We did. So December 2015, we moved to Dallas. And then I had a very short part-time job that was doing after-school programs for kids.
Mm-hmm.
And it was super stifling and a very uncomfortable job. And I really, really didn't like it. And so I was maybe there for like 2 months and I hated it. And then there was something that came up and I quit. And at that point I had just had, a show out in California and I had sold a bunch of it was the first time I'd shown the drip sculptures and I had sold a bunch of them. And so it was enough for me to kind of have, you know, a few months of like, maybe I don't have to rush to look for a job. I can like take my time and find the right new job. And then when I came back, it just continued. I just continued to sell stuff and I had the next show come up and it just kind of continued that way. And I was able to never go back to a day job.
Oh my God. That is the best story ever.
Yeah.
Was that at Spoke or is that a new California gallery for you?
The first gallery that I worked with in California, they're called Left Field.
Okay.
It is in San Luis Obispo, which is in the middle of California. It's like central California, but on the coast. And the owner, his name is Nick Wilkinson. He and I met maybe like a year before that at a group show that we were both in San Diego.
Okay. And I was going to ask, how on earth did you get a show there?
Yeah. So he actually bought my piece from this group show in San Diego. And he was like, I really like your work. Like, let's talk. I have a gallery. And yeah, we just kept in touch, and you know, we're good friends. Like, we still talk, and I still work with him to this day. But yeah, he put me in this group show in, I think, maybe April or March of 2016, last year. Wow. And yeah, it just kind of snowballed from there. It was just great. I think the context of my work with the other artists that were showing, and like the pictures that came out of it, like, it was just really exciting. I think a lot of people responded well.
Well, I mean, I feel like I see you popping up everywhere now. That's why I was a little bit like, that's why the podcast has been around for this long and I never called you, because I felt a little bit intimidated. I was like, oh, she's a pretty big deal. I don't know if she'll say yes. And then I put my big girl pants on the other day and just emailed, and you wrote back right away. I couldn't believe it. So, but yeah, you're just everywhere. And so that is so cool. It has just snowballed and you're just blobbing and dripping. And what are the latest things? Squishes. Those are insane.
Thank you. So yeah, I have names for all of them, but I have not come up with a name yet for my soft ones. And so I actually recently discovered this term called sploot.
Oh boy.
And a sploot is a position that I think it originated with corgis, but it's like when they lay down and they put their back legs out.
Yeah, yeah.
And so
my wiener dogs do that.
It's so cute. And I was like, what? I really like words, names for my pieces that are kind of onomatopoeia, like they have sound related. And so sploot is just such a good, like, because these are soft and they kind of sit there like that. So I'm kind of playing with that as maybe the next name for the soft sculptures.
Oh my gosh, that's hilarious. Well, I saw one of them, because you've done little videos, because you can't tell from Instagram, obviously, if they're squishy or hard or what.
Yeah.
So up until the splutes, they're hard, right? Like, or are they, or do they have a bit of give? Like, does the polyurethane, does it dry hard, or is there a give?
They are solid. They are soft. They are hard sculptures.
Okay.
And the part of my, you know, as the work has grown and the exposure to the work has grown, I've always had people come into my studio, like pre-Instagram, and they're like, oh my gosh, is it wet? Can I touch it? So that conversation, that dialogue, and those questions have been around for a while.
Okay.
And as time has gone on and I've exposed, you know, my work has been exposed to like a lot of people across the world, then it takes out that element of people can't touch it anymore, like through their device. But they still are asking the same questions. And so that leads me to, you know, like playing with the audience a little bit. I like the sort of tease that here's the soft sculpture, but is this other one soft or is it hard? You know, that I think is kind of like a fun,
It's like like going into a show that had both would be like a playground. And
yes.
So, but like, do you let people touch your, I mean, they can touch the squishy ones, but like, I mean, I would never just come in and start poking at your stuff.
No. So I don't, for the most part, I do not, let people touch the sculptures. What I generally try to do at most of my shows is I have one or two pieces that are kind of at the forefront or in the entrance where someone can go and you can touch it.
Okay.
And then that kind of like satisfies a little bit of curiosity, but at the same time, then everyone's like, well, what do the other ones feel like? You know, they're like, they're still curious. And so I try to alleviate some of it, but I think that in doing that, it still kind of sparks like a little tension of like maybe desire or, you know, just more curiosity.
Yeah. Well, now you've given them a little entryway and they're like, okay, let's touch it all. It's like it's like one of those touch tanks in an aquarium. It's like, okay, you can touch the starfish, but don't touch the shark.
Yeah.
And so these squishy ones I saw on Instagram, one of them has over 15 million views.
Yeah. Yes, that's crazy. It's insane. I have no idea. I just have no idea. Like, I don't know how. I didn't expect it. I am still amazed by it. I go back and I'm like, how people ask me all the time, they're like, how did you get 15 million views on that? And I'm like, I have no idea. Like, I guess maybe it was just so different in at the time, you know? Like,
yeah. And it's mesmerizing too. And and it makes you a little bit jealous that you're not the one squishing it. You know, because it's just like, it's just so, okay. So When did you start making those? Those are pretty new, right?
Yes, those are very new.
And was that a happy accident in a material situation, or were you after something that people could touch?
I wanted something people could touch.
Okay.
I am becoming more and more interested in that, in what that means when the viewer is able to interact with a piece of art.
Yeah.
And like, and then, you know, the sort of implications of like archival quality of a piece and what it, you know, what that means when like the oils get on something and
yeah.
Does it matter if it lasts a long time? And, but yeah, I made those earlier this year. I was in a group show, called Candy Castle. That my friend Ben Willis, he put together, he curated, that went with his solo show. And, you know, it was, I had wanted to make some things that kind of looked, they looked a little, you know, ice cream and like fun. And I made them for his show. And then from there, I just continued exploring the soft material.
I saw those and I gasped out loud. Like, I have loved your stuff since the get-go. Like, I'm sure I was one of the people that saw it on Instagram when you decided to put things up, because I just remember being like, what is that? And I've been following you ever since. And so I saw the Candy Castle stuff. Then there's the sparkly diamond stuff. Oh
yes.
My word. How did you fall? Like, what? I don't want you to give away your secrets, but what the hell is that?
They are Swarovski crystals.
No.
And they're, yeah, and they're hand-placed, and I don't have assistants, so I do them myself. They take a very long time. So, you know, if you see on my Instagram, like, you'll see, usually I don't repost, like, a piece. Everything's, like, new or, you know, whatever, but some of the rhinestones, I'm like, I'm just going to post this again, because it's so good, you know, it's like.
Yeah, and when you do little videos of them, and so that you can see the light bounce off, it's just like,
yes.
I want that.
They're very attractive, for sure. I'm not very, like, attached to my work in that way. Like, I don't, like, hang on to things or, like, feel sad when something leaves. But the rhinestones, like, I personally am, like, just, they're so shiny and sparkly, you know?
Yeah. Did those come from doing your little dots? Because your little, those little spiky dots on everything that are, like, you know, in neon, like a yellow neon on pink or whatever, sort of seem like the precursor to those.
Yeah, so, I mean, I've been playing with rhinestones for a while. They've just never really fit into my work at any point. And then one day it clicked, like maybe I should revisit rhinestones with these drips. The rhinestones to me, as a quick explanation, you know, the drips, the shape and the form of the drips can kind of be gross. In a way, they're kind of oozy and they're a little like, ew, like, what is that? And so to me, by putting on these like beautiful, like these brightly colored spikes, I make that form more attractive, but mm-hmm. at the same time, the spikes can hurt, like they prick. And so there's this play between, it's kind of ugly, but it's kind of beautiful. And then I want to touch it, but is it dangerous? Is it going to hurt me? And so that thinking led me back to the rhinestones. And with the rhinestones, you know, I look at, like, our culture and how we use, like, things like diamonds and crystals. And, you know, a lot of times, like, you'll see, like, bodybuilding competitions where the women in their bikinis are completely decked out with rhinestones or, like, pageantry or, you know, like, anytime, like a woman is, like, super glamorous, there, I think, are always rhinestones or crystals or something involved.
Something sparkly, yeah.
Exactly. And so I kind of paired that with the drips and the blobs, you know, it's, they're still these kind of potentially gross forms, but now they're decked out in like excessive amounts of rhinestones. And so they become something, you know, more in that way.
You're so smart.
Oh, thank you.
I love it. See, this is why I wanted to have you on. I was like, and I have this question and I have another question. Oh, so do you have a favorite, like now that you're doing these squishy ones, Are you still making the drips and stuff, or are you focusing on this, or do you go back and forth?
I go back and forth. The tendency for me is I get really, I work on multiple things at a time, and pre-grad school, I was like all over the place. Like I would work on like a few pieces and then I'd move on to the next thing and I work on a few pieces. And I think when I did grad school, it helped me hone in on those points in time where I was like, oh, I'm bored with this. Let me move on. And so what I would do is I still do this. I work on multiple things at a time. And so there's always like an experiment going on. There's always like a in progress, you know, piece going on, and there's like a piece that's about to be finished, you know, mm-hmm. And so that keeps me engaged in everything that I do. And by going back and forth between, you know, the soft ones I'm making now and experiments and then back to the drips, I discover new things as I work on the drips that, you know, I'm learning from like the other things. So it helps keep things fresh and just more exciting in the studio and, you know.
Yeah, that totally makes sense because you're also never done because when you finish one that's, you know, near the end, mm-hmm. you've still got one that's halfway along. And then,
exactly.
I find that sometimes when I finish things, then it leads into a little bit of a lull, right? Like because you don't have something going, so there's no reason to go back into the studio. So I've been trying to make sure that there's always something on the go, mm-hmm. just as that little catalyst to get back in there all the time.
Exactly. Yes. Yeah. I think that it does become, it can get easy or you can get kind of comfortable. You know, if you finish a piece, you feel good. And then you're like, well,
I guess I'll go for a donut.
Yeah. You know, cupcakes, whatever.
Yeah, whatever. Okay, here's a question that popped into my mind. So the crystals, mm-hmm. those must be expensive to buy for you.
They are.
So do you buy them in hopes that you're going to sell this piece or
So that's kind of like if I want to make some crystal pieces, like I just make sure that the next few pieces I sell or whatever is going to go towards buying more Swarovski rhinestones.
Yeah.
And for me, I've always been very like dedicated to materials. And so I've had people ask me like, why don't you use like, there's different types of rhinestones obviously. And, there's a kind called Czech Percosia, I believe is how you say it. Might be totally wrong, but it's like a, lower quality, crystal and it's not Swarovski and the cuts aren't as, they're not as detailed. So the sparkles aren't as much. Mm. And I think that you could definitely use that and, you know, get, not the same effect, but close to. And for me, like, I don't want to compromise any of that. Like, I want the best crystals I can get, which is the Swarovski crystals. So it's kind of just something I have to, budget for and make happen. But what's great is when I have people who commission work and then, you know, they pay and then.
That's what I was going to say. I wondered, like, did the first ones, the first one must have just been on you because nobody knew that you could make them, including you. But now, I was wondering if you, like, wait because you know you've got a show coming up or you know you've got a commission. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's cool. Okay. Because as soon as you said that, I was like, whoa, that's a big investment on your end. Yeah. But that totally makes sense. So you have is your show at Spoke up still right now?
No, so the show at Spoke closed at the end of October, then I was with Spoke at Context Art Fair in Miami just a few weeks ago.
Oh, okay, that's probably what I saw, I guess.
Yes.
Yeah.
And they did this, I got a whole wall, and it was really beautiful and super well curated. The gallery director, Dasha, and I have like worked together closely ever since my show and prior to the show, and she really like gets my work, and so... it's been a great experience with them and I'm super excited that I'm working with them.
Yeah, that is so good. They're a great gallery. Do you, did you go to Miami?
I did. I had a great time in Miami.
I was so jealous. I went last year and, I posted something about something. Oh, I forget who I wrote about that was in Miami. And I was like, you know, normally I don't have FOMO. I don't, you know, since I turned 40, the FOMO has kind of gone away, but I was so jealous of everyone that went to Miami this year. Mm-hmm. And then I saw your stuff and I was like, ow, because when I went last year, I just found like walking through any of those exhibitions, it's just like every corner you turn, you're like, oh my God, I love that. Oh my God, I love that.
Yeah.
Like it's just, it's just shocking the amount of great work that is there. I would have loved to seen your stuff in person because I've never seen it in person.
Oh, yeah.
I promise I won't touch it unless it says touch this.
Yeah. Well, you know, I'm hoping to continue my expansion of showing everywhere. So hopefully yeah. at some point you'll see something in person.
I hope so too. What did the sign say? I saw it on Instagram. What did the little mm-hmm. sign say about touching the squishy one?
Oh, Dasha from Spoke is the one who put that, she printed that out. It said, please touch me.
And people did it.
Yeah, people definitely were doing it. It's fun because, like, if, for me, you know, like, a lot of people don't know what I look like, and, you know, some people think I'm male.
Yeah.
And so, like, at my shows or, like, the fairs or whatever, I can stand back and kind of just watch and hear without people being like, oh, there's the artist.
Right.
And so I get to see, like, the kind of internal struggle that happens where they're like, I want to touch it, but I can't, should I? And they look, kind of look around, like, a little bit sneakily, like, to yeah. see if anyone's watching. And just the whole interaction is just really entertaining and just, like, kind of beautiful to watch.
Yeah, that is so fun when you can just sort of stand back and watch that. I remember when I, my paintings in my grad show, when I, for my BFA, I had done, I used white glue on them to make sort of blobs.
Mm-hmm.
But you couldn't really tell if they were 3D or if they were just like 2D, but painted to look like blobs, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so I was standing back just watching and people were not touching it, but pushing themselves against the wall and turning their head on the side so that they could try and see if it did stick out or not.
Mm-hmm.
And it was so fun to like just spy.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, that's so yeah. cool. I know. I think even if the sign says, please touch me, I would be like, wait, is this a trick?
Yeah,
am I going to get arrested?
Yeah.
I know. And
I kind of like that yeah. it might be a trap.
Yeah. We just imagine in Miami, all the sirens just like, woo, woo, everything goes up. Well, I, for the longest time, and I've never figured out how to do this, and I think maybe you have, but I always wanted to do a piece that, or something that expressed the idea of the mother-child relationship that an artist has with a work.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, you can go up to your own work and, like, you know, dust it off with your elbow and, like, you know, spit on your thumb and, like, rub some
yeah.
stuff off of it. But nobody would ever come and touch your work like that.
Mm-hmm.
Just like nobody would do that to your kid, hopefully. You know, and so there's something really cool about that, like the idea that you have these couple of sacrifice pieces at the front where people are allowed to touch them, but then
yeah.
only you're allowed to touch the rest. Like, there's something mm-hmm. really cool in that.
Well, thank you.
Yeah. I'm yeah. even more smitten now.
Thank you.
So do you have any shows coming up that people can see your stuff, or are you in the middle of producing again?
I have a show in Sweden in what? April.
Are you
going
to go?
Really exciting. I hope so, yes. I am, all intentions are for me to go. I definitely, the very amazing thing, you know, of course, being full-time art is amazing in and of itself, but that my work is taking me all over the place is just, it's so cool. And so I definitely try to take advantage of it. I also have this, this other thing that just popped up. And I hope it's okay that I talk about it, but, I think it's official. There's this gallery in New York called The Hole NYC.
Yes.
And they are opening like a front store, so kind of mimicking like a museum gift store.
Yeah.
But it's going to be like just a 500 square foot, like looks like a gallery space, and they're going to serve like, you know, tea and ice cream and stuff like that, but it's going to be kind of like not the main focus. And they've asked me to come in to do like a giant installation. And so I am planning on making a life-size version of these soft squishy ones.
Oh my god.
So that's coming up at the end of March, and I'm pretty sure I can make it happen. I've never done anything on that scale before.
So what are you going to do? Do you kind of like make it at home and ship it, or do you have to go there and work there?
I will probably make it here and ship it out.
Okay.
Because so the thing with my work is if I make something and it's not successful, I have to start over. There's
right.
no... There's no like scrap, like painting over, gessoing the canvas and like reusing the canvas. So I have to accommodate for any potential things that could go wrong. So like, for example, the soft foam is a little more finicky than the hard foam, and the certain densities do weird things. So like I discovered this this year that, you know, they'll sometimes shrink. They can off-gas and shrink up to like a week or 2 weeks after.
Oh.
So it
like a balloon deflating kind of?
Yeah, like it's kind of cool what they look like. They almost look like brains. Like
okay, I can see. Yeah.
Yeah, so they shrink and they get kind of shriveled, and it's much grosser than what my sculptures look like. So there may be some potential there for something, but yeah. So I will probably make it here and do like a few rounds of like smaller experiments to make sure, and then I'll execute it on this larger scale and then ship it out.
Oh my
and hopefully,
god. So like, cool.
Yeah, hopefully it works and people enjoy it. And
that's going to be like such a draw.
Yeah.
So smart for both of you guys. Okay, so one more thing before I do the not so speedy speed round. So just what you said, you know, that things can go awry even a week or two after the fact. Are you at a point now where you're like, oh, well, like you kind of expected that, or do you get like, damn it, you know, like, is it upsetting, or are you just rolling with it at this stage?
I pretty much just go with it.
Yeah.
You know, I think I know the materials well enough now. I would never say that like I've fully mastered any of it. You know, but cause I'm still learning it and pushing like what I can do or can't do with it. But if it happens, then it happens. And I make sure that, you know, my galleries and the people I work with know, you know, like, hey, it was like a really wet, rainy, like week in Dallas when I was making these things, you know, but I think that's only happened like once before, and I was rushing for a show, and I had to let the gallery know, like, just in case, like, those were the conditions I was working with.
That's crazy. It's like baking a chocolate mousse. It's like, no, it's not, it's too humid in here. The mousse will drop.
Yeah, it is. It is. There's just a lot of things you have to like take into consideration.
It's so cool that you have invented this way of making.
Well, thank you. It's pretty wild for me to think about it like that. Like I have people who reach out to me on Instagram, and even kids who are like in high school or like in, you know, college, and they're like, you're such an inspiration, and they make things that are inspired by my sculptures and they share it with me. And for me to, and I've also had like teachers like in schools, you know, say like, oh, I taught a chapter like on your work. And it's such an intense thing to kind of realize and think about that I'm influencing like a whole another generation of makers and artists.
I know. You can't even put it into words. That is so fantastic.
Yeah. And to be alive and to like to watch it happen. You know, I think a lot of times, like, you know, like the artists who inspired me, like they're like 30 years, 40 years, like my senior, you know, and they're not that close, but I'm 29 and I'm watching it happen like in real time, you know, through the internet. It's just wild.
And and you're also not like dead and famous 10 years after you died. Like you actually get to like watch all this stuff happen and have these really cool commissions and these opportunities. And oh my gosh, I cannot even wait to see where you end up going.
Me too.
Yeah. So exciting. Are you ready for the not-so-speedy speed round?
Sure, yeah.
Okay, first, do you chew gum?
Sometimes.
What flavor?
I like the fruity flavors.
Okay, that's actually perfect.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was going to say, have you got a big mouthful of Hubba Bubba? Do you guys have Hubba Bubba? Or is that a Canadian thing?
I feel like I've heard. Does it come in a roll? Is it pink?
Yes, you can get it like that. Or you get it in big cubes that are sometimes filled with goo.
Okay, yes, we have that.
You should look into it, because I think that it would be one with you and your work, especially the Skype picture that I'm looking at this entire time. It looks like pink strawberry gum oozing out of something.
Yes.
Okay, favorite Texan food?
I don't think I have a favorite Texan food. I do not like Tex-Mex, and I don't really like Southern barbecue. So
no,
yeah.
Well, there you go. I went to the only place I've ever been in Texas was Austin, and I just ate from food trucks the entire time.
Oh, Austin's great with that.
Because that's what you're supposed to do, right? And when you're talking about eating the beautiful cake until you eat one bite too many, I got a flashback of Gordo's donut.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yes. I've had that experience at Gordo's too.
Yeah, like, and then I broke into a sweat, like a, I think I might be having a heart attack sweat. Like, but up until that point, I'd been so happy. And then I was like, oh, no, I've gone too far. Do they just have them? Are they just in Austin?
They are just in Austin. Okay. I've been to the brick and mortar, so they're getting bigger.
Okay. Yeah. I was only at the Airstream. Okay. Good to know for the next time I go back there. First pet you ever had? Have you ever had a pet?
So growing up, I had a little turtle that I loved. And then my first, like, official pet on my own was my cat Frida, or is my cat Frida. And I got her when I was maybe, like, 21 or 20. And she totally, like, opened my heart up. I didn't realize how much you could love an animal, and it just,
Why did you decide to get her? Did she happen upon you, kind of?
No, I don't know how we decided. We adopted her from the animal shelter while I was in undergrad, and I just wanted a cat. I love cats. Cats are, you know, my favorite, and they're such good, like, studio, like, companions. You know, they're so, like, zen and just, like, what are they thinking about?
Yeah,
and,
you know, they're odd little creatures. They've got their own thing going on.
Yes, and yeah, I don't know what really sparked it, but I'm very glad that it happened.
Yeah, that's so nice. I had a turtle in university. His name was Sven.
Aw, turtles are cool. They're pretty cool.
I had him for years, and then I eventually had to give him, because I was moving to the other side of the country, and I wasn't allowed to take him on a plane, and so I left him with a friend, and then the friend had him for years, and then he was moving away, and so he went and asked, because I went to UVic, University of Victoria, so this friend went to the biology department and said, can I let this turtle go in a pond? Like, what will happen? And they were like, yeah, he'll be fine, put him in there. And so, I don't know, he might be like a tortoise by now.
I actually did that with my turtle. Of course, I didn't go to anywhere and ask. I just did it. So I was just a kid. But, I released my little turtle into, like, this nice little stream that I found. And I hope that he's good and still living.
He's probably swimming along. Was it one of those little red slider?
Yes.
Same. So cute.
Yeah.
okay. And then, because you are going to be the first... We're recording this before the holidays, but you're going to be the first episode in the new year, kicking off 2018. So I'm kind of putting you in the spot here, but do you have a New Year's resolution yet? Or do you have a goal for 2018?
I don't really like to do resolutions. I try to just be conscious of my... choices and decisions all year round.
Yes.
Basically, so, like, to not disappoint myself. I really, for 2018, I'm really trying to pace myself a little bit better and give myself more time to recharge between shows. I think that this year has been amazing, but very fast. And, you know, In the past couple of months after my show with Spoke, I've had, like, some moments to kind of just get back into the studio and experiment. So I'm always in the studio, but I'm not always consciously experimenting or just, like, really pushing myself.
Yeah, because you've got stuff to do.
Exactly. Sometimes it's just production mode and, you know, you have a show coming up and deadlines and stuff like that. So 2018, I'm trying to even schedule those breaks in and making sure that I recharge and I, like, take, you know, the time I need. And I'm about to go on this road trip after Christmas to the 5 national parks in Utah.
Oh.
Which I'm so excited about. I'm so excited. Like, I was looking at pictures last night and I was, like, just, like, thrilled. You know, just stuff like that. Like, that kind of thing, like, really inspires me, and I see those things, and it, you know, again, it, like, marinates, and then I take it back to the studio with me, and, you know, they come out in these new and different ways.
Yeah.
So,
and you have to go and experience things in order to keep going.
Exactly. Yes. Yeah. And I think that that's hard to do sometimes, you know, especially if like you're used to just constantly like being busy, to know that it's equally as important and vital to give yourself like breathing room.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of what I'm aiming for in 2018.
That's really smart. I think I will take that advice as well. I think sometimes too, because, you know, I freelanced for a long time, and then about a year and a half ago, I did the full jump and just quit design and just am doing Jealous Curator and my own art, which is terrifying, but, you know, it was about time basically. And, but there's that fear of, you know, as a freelancer or an independent, you know, when you don't have the 9-to-5 job, that it's like, you just better work constantly because yes, you're busy right now, but what if you're not busy next year? And so there's that panic, right? So you just go and you go and you go. But if you're good at what you do and you're successful, you will always be busy, and you are just going to run yourself into the ground until you're 100, you know? So it's like, yeah, you have to realize that, like just what you said, that those moments of calm and rest and recharging are just as important as the go, go, go. And if you don't have those moments, things will probably dry up for you, you know? Like, yes, you need to be constantly inspired and evolving.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Definitely. Yeah, you know, I think that a lot of times, especially like we talked about, like with Instagram and the quickness and just like how much you can take in, there's this kind of this, not a pressure, but, you know, like things have moved so fast, and I have all these ideas, but I'm like, I'm 29. It's only like 2 years into this, and I want like a whole lifetime, you know, of this.
Yeah.
And so
you don't have to execute all of it by April.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, I'm so happy that we finally got to talk and to hear all the inside baseball stuff. And I did not realize that this all just sort of happened for you in the last couple of years, and that you're only 29. Sweet little baby. I'm 44. And so it's just so, I cannot wait to just keep on watching and hopefully one day poke one of them myself.
Well, thank you so much. I'm really happy to have been invited onto your podcast.
Oh my gosh. I'm so glad. This was really fun and gives me an excuse to write another giant post. And I am going to take that video off of Instagram, the 15 million one, and I'll embed it in the post so people can see it. And yeah, it's been so fun chatting with you, and good luck with everything ahead of you. And the New York thing sounds amazing. Next time I'm in New York, I'm going to go there. I can poke it there.
Yeah, you could.
Yes.
And you could, like, I'm hoping that actually, not just like with your hands, but like you could potentially lay into it. I think.
Oh,
I don't know
God.
Yet.
Now there's an Instagrammable moment.
Yeah.
Yeah.
For sure.
For sure. Well, have a really great Christmas and enjoy Utah.
Thank you.
And I will talk to you in 2018.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
Thank you. I'll talk to you later. Bye.
Bye.
I loved all of that. But I think her plan to rest and recharge more often is literally the perfect way to kick off the first podcast in a new year. Let's all do that. Because as important as it is to hustle and work hard, we're all going to burn out if we don't learn to just chill out from time to time. Thank you so much to Dan for that reminder and for taking some time away from her blobs and splutes to talk to me. Thank you to Saatchi Art and Thrive Mastermind for supporting the episode. And huge thanks to you for showing up again in 2018. There will be more art for your ear next weekend. See you then.